Welcome to the StarTrek.com audio commentary for the episode Judgment. This is Tim Gaskell, editorial director for StarTrek.com. Our special guest is David A. Goodman, a producer on Enterprise and the writer of this episode's teleplay. He shares story credit with Taylor Elmore. Welcome to our podcast, your first for StarTrek.com.
Thank you, Tim. Happy to be here.
Great. This is excellent. Now,
they think you have Ray Romano, which is...
is not Ray Romano, folks. This is, in fact, David. Judgment was episode number 45 in the production order, season 2, and it was episode 19 of season 2. The great thing about Judgment is, as you will see as we go through this, is all the continuity and all the references back to Star Trek VI and even other stuff that we will enlighten you as we go along.
Plenty of continuity porn for the fans. That's exactly. That was my goal when I set out to write it.
This episode was directed by James L. Conway, who Star Trek fans will know going back all the way to Star Trek The Next Generation and the episode Justice and other ones like The Neutral Zone, DS9's Duet, classics, and even...
He did some big Klingon. I was thrilled. I mean, Jim only directed like one Enterprise episode a season, and just timing-wise ended up that he would direct this one, and he directed Way of the Warrior, Deep Space Nine, and Apocalypse Rising over there, two big Klingon episodes, and of course the Enterprise pilot, and he's just, really the king of the Star Trek directors, just a talented guy and knows the stuff and did a great, great job, I think.
Start playing the episode now.
Interesting, just starting out, that glove that he's wearing, the gavel glove, they had to get the original gavel glove from Star Trek VI and make a cast of it for this episode. He bangs that thing a lot in this episode.
Now, the sparks were done. Those were live sparks, or were those added in post?
I think some were added in post. I don't know that there's any way that they could have done that live. But you know what? I'm not sure. The courtroom sequence, I mean, obviously, the set really does resemble the one, although not exactly, from Star Trek VI, and using clever use of computer graphics, like this shot right here, you know, obviously we didn't build a three-story set. The second crowd on the second level is probably the same people that you see on the first level.
Yeah.
They just repeat it.
Yeah.
Actually, I think that might have even been true of some of the shots where you just see the one level. I'm not sure that they filled up that whole thing with all those Klingons.
I seem to remember a lot of Klingons running around that week.
There were a few, definitely. But and the show's off to a start. You know, we set up the idea of doing this flashback episode. It's kind of interesting that the whole process of this story, well, it's interesting to me, maybe not to anybody else, but Taylor Elmore pitched this story of doing Archer on Trial with the Klingons like a year before I got to Enterprise. And after I had written, I'd written Precious Cargo, was my first Enterprise script, and they were pretty much ready to fire me. And to be fair, I was rewritten a lot on Precious Cargo, so the piece of crap that aired was not the piece of crap that I wrote. They were going to fire me, but Brannon liked me enough to pick up my option. I think Rick would have let me go. But I decided I wanted to do a Klingon episode, and just because I'm a huge Star Trek fan and I wanted to do something that I was really more passionate about, just to cut off this story, this shot of this great special effects shot of the planet where the trials were taking place. It was supposed to be Narendra 3, which was this Klingon outpost mentioned in yesterday's Enterprise. And the reason was Brannon didn't want it to be the Klingon homeworld because Enterprise had been moving out into space. So I thought of this Klingon outpost on Narendra 3. I'll go back to the story in a minute of the script. I also want to talk about this first scene with Phlox. Some really nice acting between these two guys, getting the sense of tension, and it's a great way to get the exposition out. I think Phlox just mentions xenopolycythemia, which of course is the disease that McCoy had, and For the World is Hollow, and I Have Touched the Sky. That's the some of the continuity porn.
The
I mentioned
episode's
earlier.
Like three minutes in, and we've already got like five
endless continuity. The Narendra 3 thing, we never actually mentioned that it is Narendra 3, but we just didn't want it. Enterprise is 2 years out in the space, so we needed it to be an outpost. As I was breaking the story, I just thought this was a great way to get the exposition out that Archer had been taken by the Klingons, and that Enterprise was essentially there for the trial, and just some nice acting. These two guys are really some really nice underplaying of this these moments between these two actors. You really do get a sense of worry and affection from John Billingsley. He's a great actor, and this is maybe my favorite scene in the episode, just because of it's kind of touching. And anyway, so there's the plate of Targ.
I wonder what they used for that.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Something from the commissary. <perhaps?
laughs> Lunch that day. Here comes J.G. Hertzler, a little different role than Martok, which he played so well on Deep Space Nine. He plays this weary advocate, Kolos, very well, and I talked to him during the shoot, and he was very complimentary of the script, and I think we'll talk a little later about the role, but it's definitely some different acting going on here than you got an actor, he's playing a Klingon again, but it's not the same character.
It's almost the opposite
at all.
In some ways.
Yes, and he's not, I mean, Martok is very big and loud and Klingon, and this guy is much more intellectual and...
A non-warrior,
which was an important part of the story. So anyway, I was telling you the story. Taylor Elmore pitched the Klingon trial story with the possibility of a flashback. I didn't know that when I was starting to develop my Klingon story. My Klingon story that I originally developed, trying to keep my job, was... trying to develop something where we can do something a little prequely of why 100 years from now humans and Klingons are enemies, why Kirk in Star Trek VI says, you know, let them die. And I thought an interesting story would be Archer coming to the aid of people who were under Klingon rule. The Klingons, what's an empire? And, you know, Kirk in Errand of Mercy describes Klingon planets under Klingon rules as vast slave labor camps. So the original story was a group of people escaping from one of these slave labor camps and Archer helping them and sort of seeing that Archer couldn't help but help these people. And that's why Klingons and humans had to eventually become enemies, because the Klingons were this empire that subverted so many people. So that was the original, that was the beginnings of the story that I developed, which eventually become the flashback to this story, and it's an interesting road that led to, which I'll get to in a minute. I think we have our guest actor there playing Prosecutor Orak. I named Prosecutor Orak after a computer character on a British show called Blake Seven, and that was just for me.
That's obscure.
And here comes Duras, played by Dan Reardon, who starred in a TV movie I produced called The Adventures of Captain Zoom in Outer Space that I co-wrote and produced. And Dan, very good actor, very big, seemed like a perfect guy to play a Klingon, and I got him the audition. And, of course, Duras is a reference to the Duras family that we see later in Next Generation, and then he mentions the Tygo Core defense perimeter, which is in Deep Space Nine. Nothing but continuity in this first act, boy.
Yep.
I really loaded it up so that even if Brannon cut it out, there'd still be a few references left, but he left a lot of it.
Daniel had two small parts in the DS9 and the TNG episode as
well. TNG, he was Rondon in Coming of Age. He confronts Wesley Crusher in the hallway and with the webbed hands, and in Deep Space Nine, it was a much smaller role in Progress. Just played a Bajoran military officer.
Now this set, they've got a lot of mileage out of this set the last few years.
They sure did. I originally envisioned, I was hoping that we could build a new Klingon bridge set. Budget didn't allow us to do that, but I thought, you know what, I mean, the Klingon ships had to be new at some point. all the Klingon ships we ever see are these old, dark things, and I remember the ship from the motion picture, Star Trek the Motion Picture, which was new. I thought, wouldn't it be cool to see a new ship, but nobody listened to me. Anyway, fun acting here by Bakula, playing slightly evil Archer in our little Rashomon type.
From the battle cruiser.
Enterprise, yeah, exactly. And I have to give some credit to Chris Black, who did a dialogue polish on this script, and a lot of really good writing on it.
Even the lighting matches the courtroom scene in Star Trek VI.
Yeah, no, well. They did it. They were very careful about how they did this. Also, Conway knows how to shoot. I mean, look at these angles. The angle on the magistrate here is a little arch, and you're sort of looking down a little bit on. You know, Archer seems smaller in a certain way, and just the way he sets up these shots. I mean, adds so much drama and action to the proceedings of what could be a really dull scene and isn't.
Even Archer's hair, they make him look kind of. His hair is all perfectly parted.
Exactly. There. Very square.
Square.
Yeah. Now, there's a new Klingon ship. Interesting story there. I had really wanted to see the Enterprise do battle with a D7, the classic Klingon ship, which we saw in the first season. So I put D7 in the script, and there's a great effect shot. Look at that. And Rick Berman thought, well, D7 is the original series time, shouldn't this be an earlier version like a D5? Should we call it a D5? So they changed it to a D5 in the script. Then Peter Lorison thought, well, that meant a different ship, so he told Mike Okuda to design a different ship, even though Mike knew that I wanted the D7, but Peter was sure, so we got a new Klingon ship. And we didn't get to see Enterprise battle the D7, but it's a cool-looking ship.
Right.
We're igniting some plasma here, which I think we did just a little too much, especially since I think plasma is already ignited. So I don't know that I had a different way to confuse the Klingon ship so that Enterprise could attack it, but we simplified it to igniting plasma. Did that? I think every week we ignited some plasma.
Plasma always work somehow.
Yeah, it's you amazing. Can ignite that plasma. It, yeah. You know, causes difficulty. You'd think they'd be prepared for it every once in a while. Back to the telling of the story. So I'm developing this Klingon story, and I submit sort of several outlines to Brannon. And Brannon, I couldn't get a reaction from Brannon. I still felt like I was about to be fired, but I was trying. I was working really hard. I don't know. Around this time, my option was coming up, and I didn't know whether they were going to pick it up. I think Chris Black and John Scheiben really fought hard, and Brannon liked me. I'm being hard. I'm being funny, making fun of this. But Brannon took my Klingon idea and he matched it with Taylor Elmore's trial. He took my idea and he stuck it in the middle of Taylor Elmore's trial episode. Sent it to Rick. Rick signed off on it, and I kind of, then said, "Well, if no one's doing that one, I'll do it." And Brannon said, "Okay." So then I spent. I think it was around this time they picked up my options, so I was a little more relaxed, although I was working hard. I started writing story outlines, and I wrote several story outlines, nailing down the story, and eventually nailed down what would become pretty close to what the final episode was, and they signed off on me going to script, and the week I got sent off to script, my wife broke her foot. So it was a bad month for me to be writing a script, but it took me a lot longer because I was taking care of my kids. Not that anybody cares about this. Anyway, it was a lot of fun writing. I really wanted to write something when I developed a story. I really wanted to write something about, at the time, it was in 2002, I think, and right after 9/11, and the country was caught up in this war fever. America, we were at war in Afghanistan, and it looked like we were headed towards Iraq, and there really was a feeling for me of a change in our country that we were becoming more of this war-footed country for some good reason. I don't, I'm not taking anything away from 9/11, but it was kind of scary. I mean, we were going to war everywhere. We were going to go, and we were going to kill people, and I thought that might be an interesting backstory for the Klingons, because I've always felt the biggest problem with the Klingons is they can't all be warriors. You can't have warrior accountants. You can't have somebody's got
a warrior dentist.
There you go. You need, well, actually looking at their teeth, maybe they don't have dentists. But you need people to do something in the society, but the warriors are the ones who are out in space, so that's who you know. That's who the Klingons are known for. But back on Klingon, you needed, I thought it'd be nice to try to fill out Klingon society in a way to say that they weren't always all warriors, that there were other factions in the society, and that the warrior class became dominant. And that I thought there was some interesting parallels to be drawn to the United States, which was out in the world, American soldiers are really representing the United States. And to a lot of countries, the only thing they know about Americans are guys in uniform, are our warriors. And there's obviously more to us than that. And not taking anything away from our soldiers. Don't want to get in trouble with anybody. So that's really where this started. And then also setting up where the Klingons end up 100 years from now, sort of saying 100 years from now, there's the Klingons in the original series who are a lot different, a lot less concerned with honor than the Klingons of the TNG era. So I thought it might be interesting from a prequel to say this is a trend in Klingon society, that they're becoming more sort of devious and they're expanding their empire and they're becoming the Klingons that we know in the original series, but that there are the seeds of a society that's concerned about honor, and that's who they eventually become in TNG, and I thought this could be sort of the beginning of an explanation of that. That was just sort of filling it out within the context of this story of Archer, who ends up really helping Kolos stand up and be the Klingon he wants to be, I guess is the simplest way to put it. And because Archer's a human and he cares and he's going to do everything he can to help people and as a result, come into conflict with these Klingons. I hope that wasn't boring.
Not at all.
Initially, in the original, in my first draft of the script, I wanted to, which didn't end up getting shot, but I really wanted, I didn't want Kolos to reveal as much as he reveals here. I sort of wanted it to be slightly more subtle that Archer teases him with the idea of, you haven't heard my side of the story. Maybe if you heard my side of the story, you would change your mind, and that is the reason that Kolos gets him the chance to testify here. It's a little more blunt, you know, stand up for truth and do what's right. And
Kolos is kind of weary from the tradition and the protocols.
Right.
And he's just
doing his job.
It's almost like he doesn't have time for him yet. He
right.
And the trust.
Exactly. And I like the sort of the passivity of Kolos up to a point, because I think that also explains why so many of us who may not agree with us always being on a war footing never really do anything about it. We go in, we raise our kids and go through our lives. And I thought that was kind of a relatable thing too, for this character.
I love I love the hood of the magistrate there. It reminds me of the guy in the Led Zeppelin movie, The Song Remains the Same, in Dazed and Confused. I'm sure that was the inspiration.
Some people online have pointed out that calling this a tribunal is inaccurate because a tribunal would have three judges.
Yeah, that's not necessarily true. A tribunal can actually just be a court.
Ah, yeah. Okay, there you go.
So
I guess those people on the message boards don't always know what they're talking about. Shocking.
There's more than one. There's more than one definition.
That's good.
It's perfectly acceptable to call this a tribunal. Yeah.
The interesting side note. The actor playing Orak also guest starred on a sitcom that I wrote. I was a sitcom writer and still am for many years, and he also guest starred on an episode of Stark Gravy Mad that I wrote.
That's John Vickery.
John Vickery, yeah.
John was Gol Russat in seventh season of DS9 and was also in a TNG episode, NYPD Blue, and he was also in a couple of soap operas, The Edge of Night and One Life to Live.
Oh. I saw him on Broadway in a Tom Stoppard play called The Real Thing like 20 years ago, too.
Great thing about Ron Sirma and the casting department. They always got great actors.
They sure did. It's hard. The style of acting on Star Trek is a formality to it. You can't really be a sort of classic, naturalistic kind of actor if you're playing these alien roles. They have to embody so many sort of traits that are not human. And they find the right guys who can do it. This would have been probably the first scene of the show that I developed, finding this damaged ship. And again, I sort of wanted it to be these escaped slaves. We ended up saying that the Klingons had annexed their planet and used up all their resources, which I think softened it a little bit. I think it would have been better if they had been escaped slaves or escaped from a planet where they were enslaved, and then the Klingons chasing them and calling them rebels, because I think that technically they would be really, really be rebels in that way if they had escaped from a place where the Klingons were controlling them. This actor, though, is very good playing this sort of sick, damaged alien. I named them the Aronsen, although we never hear their name in dialogue, after my friend Michael Aronson, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer for the New York Daily News, just wow. For anybody.
Impressive.
I went to college with him. We were both Star Trek geeks in college.
Nice. Now, this was one of the few scenes shot on Stage 8.
Yeah. The other piece of it was, this was Phlox's only scene of the show. The other reason we gave him that first scene of the show was he didn't get much to do in the episode, and we liked giving him that first scene, giving him a piece of acting to do.
Almost the entire episode was shot on Stage 9.
Right.
With the
Klingon stuff.
Yeah. They spent one day, I think one day on the bridge and here.
Right. You saw in that scene also some nice acting by Scott. Really, one more thing the Klingons have done that are just like, am I going to really be able to live with this kind of look on his face? That I think really plays well in the episode, that this is a guy who doesn't have any choice about how he's going to respond to the situation, even though it's going to cause him a great deal of difficulty.
This is, from a personal note, this is only one of, I think, two episodes that I saw filmed from this season, and I think it's this scene right here.
Is that right? So it's really, you know, there's like 10 Klingons, and we turn them into 100, so.
Right.
So then, this is a nice scene between T'Pol. Again, we ended up having to cut some stuff that set up that the Vulcans were letting the Klingons expand, and that that they weren't going to get in the Klingons' way until they threatened Vulcan interests, which I thought you're sort of then playing the side of non-interference, and that this is something Archer is not comfortable with. All that's sort of left of it is T'Pol's line, empires have a tendency to expand, which I think is still a nice touch of it's only going to get worse. Is that nice shot of that Klingon
kind
ship?
Kind of intimidating shot.
And now we get to see the Rashomon from the other side. Dan Reardon did a great job as Duras, so much so that Brannon and Rick brought him back for the season finale of The Expanse. And at the end of this episode, we know that Archer's I hope I'm not giving away the ending. Archer's a fugitive from justice, and we played that at least for one beat, never called it back again in season 3, and I don't think they ever mentioned it in season 4 either, so. And some of the fans have complained, I think, about, I mean, fans always find some reason to complain, but the fans have complained that it feels like this episode's a ripoff of Star Trek VI, and I didn't rip off the story. It was more, it's a Klingon trial episode. I thought it'd be fun to see these sets on our show.
And it's what's fun is the fact that the system of justice is so totally alien to what we're used to, and it's kind of like Cardassian justice as well. You're guilty until proven guilty, basically.
But sort of saying also that's a step down a road that the Klingons are on, that it hasn't always been that way, which I like. I think Connor was supposed to be in this scene too, and he got violently ill. Hopefully not from reading my script, but he was ill, and I think we cut him out of the scene. He's in one scene in the episode, and I think he was actually sick filming that scene too. It was very—I don't quite remember what he had, but he was originally obviously he would be in this scene naturally. And, that the Klingon—we were talking about Klingon justice. I thought that the idea that it's kind of an evolving thing, that we stopped asking, that Klingons have stopped asking for both sides of a story, that they have the story they want to get out, and that's what they want, but that Kolos remembers a different time, which we talk about later in the script.
Right.
It's always fun to see a battle scene. Never get tired of them. Dan had a lot of fun chewing the scenery as a Klingon, and liked coming back. He called me and wanted to come back again, but I guess they'd had enough of him. But talented guy.
Well, the one great thing about being an actor on Star Trek is oftentimes they did, you know, very few actors did one episode. They seem to all do at least
more than one.
A couple,
yeah. They like you and they remember you.
The lighting on the Klingon ship is always wonderful.
Yeah. Nice blaster shot there. And these are some just beautiful effects. I mean, you know, how far special effects have come. It was interesting. I was watching that final episode and seeing the Enterprise D and 10 years after it was on Next Generation, and just seeing how much effects have come in that time, and the fact that you could do an episode like this with this many battle scenes, this extensive battle scene, and then a ring system around the planet and exploding plasma, and
right, when you think of just how much it costs probably to do the opening credit sequence to Voyager
alone, yeah.
And here they can do that stuff every week.
Every week, and really, it's just great. And here we got our exploding plasma coming up here. Always nice, nice big blue thing. I didn't get tired of seeing this again.
So we do establish that is the D5 ship, right?
That is now a D5.
But they
don't
say it in dialogue.
No, they never say it in dialogue.
But you heard it here.
But you heard it here. It's the D5, which was supposed to look exactly like the D7. So
just an earlier model.
Model, but then they gave us a new ship. It's always good. And we never saw, I don't think we ever saw that Klingon ship again either. I think we then had a proto bird of prey at the end of the season in the Expanse that Duras chases the Enterprise with. And I don't know. They did some Klingon episodes in season 4. I don't remember what ships they used, though.
He has wonderfully straight and well-managed hair. Yeah.
So then the interesting thing here, again, this sort of happened in the rewrite, which I think it works well, the idea that Archer's done so much for the Klingons already that why did we convict them? Again, in my first draft, it was somewhat different in the sense that I thought it would be interesting if it was Archer's acted honorably, he acted like a warrior. What's happened to Klingons that we don't respect how he fought to help these people? I think they rewrote it, that made it more sort of about Archer and what he's specifically done for the Klingons. I think I obviously like my way better, but this works very well. It's very well acted, and it's pretty close to what I had. It's just what Kolos is talking about is more specific. And it makes sense. It makes sense to make this change. It makes it a much clear decision on the magistrate's part to not to commute his death sentence. I think that in that way, the rewrite helps the story in why the magistrate would not just execute him. It's, this guy has done things for important people in the Klingon Empire, and so can't really kill him. This scene changed a little, although it's still basically what I was talking about at the beginning in terms of this is the heart of the story right here, which is Kolos talking about how he's watching his society change, and I really was talking about what was at that moment going on in the United States, that everybody's ready to fight wars and say that, you know, might is right and the, you know, fight what we want is right and what and if you're not with us, you're against us. And there was a little bit more to Kolos' speeches along those lines about the youth and how they're all, you know, gung-ho.
Becoming warriors,
and that's what everybody wants to be. And I suppose if I wanted to make it more about the United States, I should have said that all the Klingons' kids want to be celebrities. But I don't know what kind of Star Trek story you get from that. So
they want to be on reality shows.
They want to be on their own, under their own album. But I got a nice couple of nice compliments from J.G. Hertzler for this stuff, which I appreciated. He seemed to agree with my politics. So I guess they're a little left leaning. If that bothers anybody. The nicely played scene, though, between these two guys. Again, some of Scott did great work here as a guy who wasn't going to, you know, was a man of integrity, was standing up for what he believed in, and yet he was probably going to die for it, and seemed weary but also determined, and helps this person, Klingon, recognize what's important. And Scott's, you know, just underplaying it, I think, beautifully. I was really happy with his performance. I always liked him. But
well, when you go back and watch some of these episodes and see what Scott does, he is just an amazing actor.
Yeah, he's great.
He's always note perfect. There's never a wrong kind of reaction from Scott.
So it's a kind of a talky scene, but this is really where all the meat of that stuff that I was talking about, and then also sort of setting up where the Klingons were headed and everything. J.G. Hertzler actually wanted to come back, too, in this role as a member of the crew. I don't know that that was going to happen, but...
it would be fun, because we've seen him play, what, one role as... on DS9, I believe, where he actually looked more like himself. But nobody actually knows what he looks like.
Yeah, that's true.
He's safe there.
I just watched him on 6 Feet Under, too. He's got a sort of a small role in that as well. And so, interestingly, I'm talking about the last act, where we end up going... Obviously, Archer gets sentenced to Ruripente. The original act, actually, was... not going to be on Ruripente. It was originally Enterprise was going to try to intercept the prison ship that Archer was on and rescue him from that. And as we were breaking that, Brennan really liked that part of the story so much, though, that he decided it was a whole episode. And he and John Scheiben worked that out, and it became, and Chris Black all worked on that story, and it became Canamar later in the season. So since we knew it couldn't be a prison ship, we had to then think, well, where does this last act take? And I said, and this was really where I said, well, I want to go to Ruripente, just because I'm a huge fan. I think Star Trek VI might be my favorite Star Trek movie. I saw it 10 times the winter it came out.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And so I thought, well, let's go to Ruripente. I mean, you know, it's known throughout the galaxy as the aliens' graveyard. It's been around for a while, obviously, right? So... obviously that might piss off some fans too, that we're just stealing from Star Trek VI, and I guess we are, obviously we are, but again, I don't think that's what the story is about, but you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. Anyway, so we we're going to Ruripente, and then as we're breaking the story, we're talking about, do we do the rescue? And I lobbied hard for this to be a two-parter, because to me, so we're playing the Ruripente. Act four is going to be in Ruripente, and we were talking about, the rescue attempt and how we would handle that. And I actually lobbied hard for this to be a two-parter, because I thought there was something fun about doing an episode where T'Pol was in command of the Enterprise and Archer's on Ruripente for an extended period of time. And I actually think it would have helped sell the idea at the end of this episode if Archer had been on Ruripente for a long period of time, like if he had a full beard, maybe his hair had grown out a little bit, that everybody felt like it was a little too easy the way the show ends with the risk, Malcolm just showing up. And if he'd been there for a while, you wouldn't probably have had that problem. You would have bought that they'd been working on their escape plan. But I still like the fact that he's convicted, he's sent, that we have the scene coming up where, on the bridge where T'Pol is going to be in command for a little while, and we're just going to let Archer go. I also want to mention the Duras's ship is named the Bortas, which is, I believe, in the Klingon dictionary means revenge, which is also the name of Chancellor Gowron's ship in some TNG episodes. What's the Redemption, parts 1 and 2?
Yep.
So it was a nice touch also to have Kolo sent to Ruripente with him for a year. So here we are in the Enterprise Bridge, and this, I think Connor's pretty sick during the filming of this scene, but I really like the idea of doing a whole episode where T'Pol was in command, but I couldn't sell it. And still a nice touch. She takes command and says, we'll get him out. We'll figure out a way. We'll get him out. And everybody sort of has to listen to her, and it makes so much sense. I mean, Reed's ready to lead a rescue attempt, and so is Trip. And I think it's really a nice moment of, we can't always break everybody out of wherever we want to break them out.
But it's the human emotion versus the Vulcan
right.
logic.
Exactly. And I really like that scene. I think it's well acted, despite whatever ailment Connor had. I don't really remember. He was very sick. I mean, it was like he was not at work for a few days, which is very unusual.
And it's not like they can always just write you out of a particular episode.
Right, exactly.
Now, is this a stock?
No,
shot, or is this a digital?
You know what it is. This is not the shot. This is not a shot from Star Trek VI. That is a new effect shot of Ruripente, probably shot over a stock shot from somewhere of
like
an ice field. But we didn't send a unit up to the North Pole to shoot. But they did do a new effect shot. I thought they would just use stock. I think I said in the script, use stock footage, and they not going to let that happen. It's amazing how hard the production people worked on this show. I mean, it's really remarkable how.
Absolutely. The ice that you actually see here on the ground is rock salt.
Yeah.
And in the call sheet, they told people to wear old shoes so they wouldn't ruin their shoes and to avoid contact with their eyes. So that ice is salt.
These are our cave sets painted white. We've seen a lot of these cave sets, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Probably the only...
There's the paint stick.
Paint sticks. Some Klingon paint sticks coming in here. The probably the only downside is, you're so used to seeing these cave sets, they don't really conjure up another planet anymore. They just conjure up Star Trek caves. They did their best, but there's only so much you can do when you've seen these same sets since 1987. these same cave sets painted different colors. After a while, the audience comes white noise
from another angle, and hope nobody will notice.
This dialogue coming up. This are all humans like you? Does he say stubborn and Kolo says stupid? It's a very funny line. Chris Black wrote a lot of good lines in the script are Chris's. He's a very funny, good writer.
Well, Kolos's speeches, a couple of them tend to peel back the layers of the false Klingon bravado so well.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of nice here, a little like friendship forming. I think if you'd had a sense that they'd been there a while, I think it's hard to tell just how long they've been there if you just count on Scott's
facial hair. I'm saying
facial hair, and what is that, 3 days?
No more,
I mean, a week. That's what I look like after a couple of days.
Well, this was the last scene. This was the last day of filming,
yeah.
So they very cleverly put this at the end so he could have his natural beard.
That's not a bad shot of the caves. It looks like an extended mining system. They don't have those laser gun things that they had in Star Trek VI, but this is 100 years earlier, so maybe they're still using the ice picks. So here comes our rescue, our little tee-up of is somebody coming to kill Archer, and it's, of course, not. It's his rescue, and it's Malcolm. And
So where's the dilithium?
You know, it's got to be in that white there somewhere. they've been digging on Rurapente for 100 years. I mean, that thing must just be made out of dilithium.
The
whole planet's just dilithium,
yeah, probably.
You know, if Reed's there to rescue him, why is he holding the axe up? No, I'm just being a nitpicker. nice touch. I think Hertz was acting in that. He seems very scared, actually. He's sort of, leave us alone. There's this kind of a fear in his voice, which I really, you know, again, a nice touch. Not Klingon bravado, but rather, you know, leave us alone. And there's a real kind of fear in his voice. And here is really, I think, I find this ending, from a story point of view, very satisfying. It ends up being really Kolos's story, that here's this guy who had given up, who hadn't done it, who was just going along in his life, and Archer was kind of this catalyst for him, and here he's willing to risk his life for another year on Rurapente to sort of now fight for what he believes in, which I think is a nice Star Trek story. I don't know.
It does make sense. You know,
yeah.
He's got a sense of pride as well, and you know, he's got the Klingon thing, but
yeah.
He does feel an obligation. He does feel almost guilt.
And yeah, and it's and it maybe sows the seeds that he serves as an example, so that other Klingons over time stand up for honor and not just glory but honor as well.
Right,
and, which is who Worf is and Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. Again, you see here coming up, again, Jim Conway directing. I mean, these are obviously sort of standard shots here, over-the-shoulder shots for this dialogue. But then when you go to the handshake, Jim does something which I really liked, which is he goes to this very low angle and you could just show the a lot of directors would have just show the handshake, but there you go. It just adds this level of drama to these two guys shaking hands. You just for that minute, you feel, second, you feel a little bit of connection between these two. There's also a shot, I was there for this, the filming of this, and the shot they didn't use, which I think possibly because the cave sets weren't holding up too well to JG's hitting it with the axe, but originally you just sort of saw JG just slowly chipping away at the walls, which is sort of a nice little metaphor for what he's going to do with his life. He's just going to chip away at it. And instead, we pull back to this shot, which is a very nice shot, but I think the cave sets didn't hold up to his pickaxe to him.
He was going to destroy them. Well, great. Thank you, David. That was excellent.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it.
Well done.
I hope somebody else
did. And that was a great kind of start to, because by this point we hadn't done a lot of episodes that had a lot of Star Trek continuity
right.
to them. This is one of the first ones that really began that took off later on.
Yeah, well, I got there and I wouldn't let up. So I was very happy that they let as much in as they did. And,
right.
Watch Family Guy, 9 o'clock Sunday nights on Fox, which is where I work now.
Yeah, and David wrote the Where No Fan Has Gone Before.
Yeah, episode of Futurama, that's right.
Futurama, which is an award-winning episode. You've probably all seen it either at Star Trek conventions or on DVD. It's a great episode.
Oh, thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this exclusive audio commentary. Please visit StarTrek.com often for more exciting features.